Hey guys, it's Nick. Before we get going today, I wanted to give you a few discount codes for the products we love and our show sponsors. So don't just turn this one off. If you're listening to this podcast, we at Hardwick Life want to reward you for your loyalty. So take 25% off of your order by using the code HardwickFF25, because after this long, we consider you friends and family. That's HardwickFF25 at Hardwick.life. It's like Hardwick.com, but that one was taken by a shirt company. So Hardwick.life is where you can find it. For 20% off at BubsNaturals.com, use the code Hardwick20. That's Hardwick20 at BubsNaturals.com. And for 10% off at Julian Bakery, use the code Nick Hardwick. That's me at JulianBakery.com. Again, Nick Hardwick at JulianBakery.com. Now, if you want to hear what I take daily and get some insight as to what you should take, maybe stay tuned. If not, skip ahead about a minute and we will be into the show. Thank you all. All right. So you want to know what you should buy? I take 6 of our Hardwick Life products every day. I originally started that company out of kind of selfish needs. I wanted to get access to the absolute highest grade products in the world. Our supplements are pharmaceutical grade, all of them. They've got unique delivery mechanisms. So you aren't just getting expensive urine. You're actually absorbing the products at a higher rate than cheaper store-bought supplements. I take Brain, Joint, Fuel, Phyto, Pump, and Neuro. Now, that may be a little extreme for you, but those are my jams. Now, I've done a lot of damage to my body. I need all of them. The Brain and Joint, they're kind of self-explanatory, right? Fuel is one of the only whey protein powders that I can take that doesn't upset my tummy. And we hear the same thing quite frequently from folks that don't process dairy all that well. That's because it's made from New Zealand grass-fed whey. New Zealand has the highest dairy standards in the world. There's a noticeable difference, and the flavor, it's pretty damn incredible. For a peri-workout drink, which peri-workout, you'll hear that term, it means around your workout, or to add protein midday, I put 2 scoops of Fuel with Pump, which has 3 grams of creatine per serving, 400 milligrams of ATP, which is the body's energy currency, and 95 milligrams of caffeine to get you all fired up. All of those, they allow you to do more work in the gym, getting better results. More work equals better results. Who would have thought? Seriously, you can work harder and have a lower rate of perceived exertion. And I like to add in Phyto, which has all of the necessary nutrients, vitamins, and minerals, along with this patented formula called TrueBrock, which contains glucoraphanin, which researchers at MIT are calling the fountain of youth. And lastly, I take Neuro about an hour before bed. Dr. Andrew Huberman, a Stanford neuroscientist, host of the Huberman Lab podcast and recent guest with Joe Rogan, I'm sure some of you listen to that guy, he's pretty awesome, recommended in our 3rd episode ever, we got him before he blew up, magnesium L-threonate, as it's the only form of magnesium to cross the blood-brain barrier. And it increases levels of brain magnesium, and that leads to better cognition and a more robust memory. That's important. It also has a slight sedative effect to help you get to sleep. All right, I'm not going to bore you with more details. Get over Hardwick Life and use the code HardwickFF25 for 25% off. Now, you guys that have been following me for a while now know that I've used Bubs Naturals since the company's inception. I don't know. I may be their first ever ambassador. I know there's a lot of bigger names now that are promoting Bubs. The company has blown up and is thriving because many folks like me understand how great their product is. I take 2 scoops of their collagen protein and 1 scoop of the MCT oil powder daily with my morning coffee. Try it once, you're going to be hooked. It's unbelievably creamy. The collagen is also really a great way to sneak some protein into your kids' lives too. It's unflavored, so you can add it into pancakes, oatmeal, mac and cheese, or juice, and they're not going to notice a thing. Use the code HARDWICK20 for 20% off. Lastly, before we get to the show, I want to tell you about my friends at Julian Bakery. This company, they've really got their act together. I believe most people could use more protein in their lives. It's got a very positive effect on satiety, brain signaling, and maintaining a healthy body weight. I recommend 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. Please don't listen to Zac Efron's trainer, who on their show falsely ties too much protein to kidney failure and loss of bone density. And certainly don't go to the Game Changers propaganda documentary on Netflix for your science. Neither of these use actual science. There's a lot of kooks out there, folks. We're going to keep fighting the good fight. I love a variety of protein. Obviously, I've told you about our whey protein, Bubs Collagen Protein. And Julian Bakery's specialty, in my opinion, is their egg white protein powder. They come in ridiculous flavors like pumpkin pie, coconut, maple glazed donut. They blend easily. They're a great addition in the middle of the day. Use the code Nick Hardwick for 10% off. That's Nick Hardwick for 10% off. All right, that's enough. Let's get you back to the show. Love y'all. Casey, here we go, buddy. Let's talk about fats.
Let's do it.
What role do dietary fats play in the body?
Fats are critical for humans, both for performance and for health. We have certain essential fatty acids, which are, you know, by definition, and their term should clue you in, they're essential, which means that if you don't eat them, eventually you will die. So they must be doing some very important stuff in the body. some things that, you know, might be very key to fat rolls are things like energy production. They help us, you know, produce energy for our bodies. They're also a critical component in the cell membranes. So every single piece of you is a cell, and, you know, the structure of those is made by fats. We also have things like signaling molecules that are made by different fats. Also, the signals themselves are transmitted through your neurons, which are wrapped in a sheath, kind of like, you know, how you have the sheath around a wire, you know, electrical signals. But in our bodies, those sheaths are made by fats. And so if you don't have, if you have like an error in fat metabolism or fat synthesis, you can actually inhibit those neural transmissions that are going on. But something that's probably a little bit more familiar to people, aside from everything that was very sciencey that I just listed, fats are essential for the development of hormones. And so if you have low fat intake, then your hormone synthesis is going to be severely impaired. Other things that fats do, we have a suite of vitamins. We call them the fat soluble vitamins. And so if you don't have fat in your diet, then aside from all of the other issues, you're also not going to be absorbing some of these fat soluble vitamins. So those are vitamin A, D, E, and K. We call those the fat soluble vitamins, ADEC. And you know, hormones comes with some downstream effects of effects on mood. It also comes with, injury risk and all those kind of things. So fats do a lot of really important stuff for us. And it pains me sometimes when people go into these extremely low fat diets, trying to lose weight, and they start running into issues.
It's interesting you talk about the extremely low fat diets. We watched a show on the History Channel called Alone, where they put these contestants out alone in the wild. Season 6 was crazy. It was in the Arctic region. Mm. And so one of the huge issues was they weren't getting enough fat, dietary fat in their life. And they were losing weight regardless of how much protein they were ingesting. They were just melting away. And they were getting dangerously low. So a lot of them had to be like medically evacuated out. So interesting you say that. So is there a minimum amount of fat that we should be having on kind of an average daily basis?
Yeah. And one quick note that I want to say about what you just said, which is really fascinating stuff. They actually call it rabbit starvation, where in some Arctic areas, you know, like if your only source of food is these rabbits that have very little fat on them, you'll start to starve despite the fact that you can eat until your stomach's ready to explode. You can eat 20 pounds of rabbit and you'll still feel ravenous. It's crazy.
Yeah. So they do, they hunt a lot of hare, they trap a lot of hare and they get them, but then they're still just in there, get a bunch of them, but they continue to lose weight. One guy even shot a moose, which I think he gathered like 600 pounds of meat off of this thing. And he had, I thought it was like 15 or 20 pounds of fat harvested from the moose, but it got stolen by Wolverine. So that was almost the end of his rope. But thankfully, some other people had some things go wrong where he was able to be the last man standing. But he was definitely the most skilled, but he got this fat stolen from the Wolverines, which ended up, it was going to be his demise.
Oh boy. Yeah, that's fun. I got to check that show out.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Season, start with season 6. You'll get hooked.
Start with season 6. Okay.
Start with season six.
Okay. So back to your question, is there a certain amount that you should be getting? I think on average, there isn't really any hard and fast rules for this, but the numbers that I like to recommend are anywhere from 1 to 1.5 grams of fat per kilogram of body weight per day. So if you weighed, say, 70 kilograms, then you would have as a minimum about 70 grams of fat per day. And that includes a little bit of a buffer just to make sure that you're fine. And most people like having some fat in their diet. It makes things taste more satiating and so on. So that's a good amount that'll keep you safe from any sorts of deficiencies.
As a registered dietitian, how concerned are you with introducing cholesterol to the diet and minimizing that?
So dietary cholesterol actually is very interesting, because dietary cholesterol, so what I mean by that is what you ingest from food. So, classically people say that eggs have a lot of cholesterol in them, and so you shouldn't eat them. However, dietary cholesterol has essentially zero effect on your blood cholesterol levels. So okay. What you eat does not influence your blood levels in terms of cholesterol. What actually matters is the fats that you're consuming, because cholesterol just gets broken down through the digestive processes, and then it doesn't get converted directly back into cholesterol. However, if you're eating certain types of fats and a lot of fats, then what that can do is that can be synthesized into cholesterol. However, usually cholesterol synthesis and high cholesterol levels are downstream effects of increased energy intake, excessive energy intake and on your step towards things like obesity and different metabolic disorders. So there's not like a very clear link between what you eat and your cholesterol levels immediately. So with that, as a registered dietitian, I know different government guidelines have initially stipulated, but they're starting to revise their statements after the science is coming out more. And so my personal recommendation, there are a couple people, or there's a very small subset of the population who is a hyper responder to dietary cholesterol and fats and things like that.
Okay.
And if you are one of those people, you probably know it, or you can figure it out very easily. So there are some people who should be avoiding dietary cholesterol, but for most of us, it's okay. And for athletes in particular, who I like to work with, dietary cholesterol is actually shown to be anabolic, which is nice. So, for the people who are looking to repair their muscles and to build muscle tissue, as well as different lean and connective tissues, dietary cholesterol can actually be a good thing.
How do people know if they should be concerned with introducing it?
Just go blood get panels? Your, yeah, just go get your blood panel once a year, get your physical, if you keep tabs on what you're eating before. If you're otherwise healthy person and, all of your lab values are coming back fine, and, you're exercising, you're not overweight, and you have some, startling blood cholesterol levels, then there might be something going on there. It could be like a genetic factor. It could be something going on. So, that's kind of one way to check it, but talk to your doctor, just get some blood done and you'll be able to see.
And one more thing that piqued my interest, how can athletes use cholesterol as an anabolic agent?
Yeah. So there's been data showing that people who are consuming more cholesterol tend to have more more cholesterol as well as more saturated fats. And you consume both of these, and the people who consume more tend to have higher circulating levels of testosterone. So it's not, no one's done a study as far as I'm aware yet. I think there was a supplement that came out a couple of years ago that was trying to look at this, but I'm mixing it up. So there was a supplement that tried to use a product from an egg, but it was like a specific molecule. It wasn't the cholesterol, but anyway, so I don't know any studies that exist, truthfully, where someone gave someone cholesterol and was like, let's see how much muscle you gain from this. But what you do see is when you do these cross-sectional studies is that people who are eating more eggs or eating more dietary cholesterol, they have more circulating levels of testosterone and on average higher lean tissue amounts. So we're kind of making a little bit of a jump here, but right. it's more to say that there isn't really data that dietary cholesterol is bad, and there's some data that suggests it might be beneficial for muscle anabolism.
So saturated fats have been demonized. What's the concern with saturated fats, and is the demonization, is it justified?
So I'm going to say no, is okay. The short answer. However, saturated fats describes a class of molecule and not just one particular molecule. And so in chemistry, a saturated fat is something where it has no double bonds. And you don't need to know what that is. All it means is it's a chemistry term. It's not like it's not a bad term. It just means it's chemical structure. And there are many molecules that have that chemical structure. And some of those saturated fats are very cardioprotective and beneficial for your health. And then there are some saturated fats that are the opposite, that are detrimental to your health. And so to put a blanket statement that all saturated fats are bad is, at first it's just off of that observation alone, it's already unfounded, right? I mean, like there are some that are good, some that are bad, and some that do nothing. However, the typical logic for the bad saturated fats goes that, you know, it says like, okay, saturated fats cause increase in cholesterol. We don't actually know for sure there is data to show that increased saturated fat does raise your cholesterol, but it's tenuous and it depends on a lot of other factors. And then it says, okay, well, dietary cholesterol causes heart disease, and people with heart disease have high cholesterol levels. Therefore, saturated fats are bad. And that logical link, there's a lot of gaps in there that don't really make sense. And what you're seeing is that a lot of government guidelines have been revised, and they're having to say that, you know, dietary saturated fat is, you know, something that isn't causing atherosclerosis and heart disease.
Okay.
And so our guidelines and like our position statements from research organizations, they've been revised in the last decade or so with their stance on saturated fats. And yes, to the best of our knowledge, 50 years ago, we thought saturated fat was the devil and the worst thing ever. And, but science grows and we learn and we get better and we can really tease out what's good and what's bad. And one of the big issues is that you can't define a food by a single nutrient within it. You can't say like this egg, just because it has a saturated fat in it, it makes the egg bad. It's like the egg has all sorts of vitamins, all sorts of minerals. It's got protein in it. You know, it's got like all these goodies in there. And you can't just say, oh, because it has this one thing in it, it's now bad. And to isolate out those nutrients, that's not something that a human ever does when they're consuming their food. They're eating foods, even heavily processed foods. The only time where they're eating like a true pure source of molecule is like if you're going to guzzle a bottle of olive oil or something like that, or like, you know, like just take spoonfuls of pure sugar or salt or something like, but otherwise, you know, you're not doing that. So it's more in the confines of where is that saturated fat coming from? What's the food source that it's coming from? And if you look at all of the foods that have saturated fats, you will see that on average, they're bad for you. And that's kind of where it comes from. And that makes sense because we use saturated fats to increase shelf life of a lot of our products that are unhealthy, like a lot of our snack items. We throw it into a bunch of our processed protein products, things like hot dogs, hamburgers, pizza, fried chicken, you know, chips and pastries and all these other goodies that, you know, Western diet loves. They're loaded with saturated fats. And it's not because of the saturated fats that those are bad. There's a lot of other bad stuff in them. And so then that kind of brings down the saturated fat literature. But if you're going to eat, you know, a boiled egg, that's very good for you, incredibly nutritious. So you got to look at where it's coming from. And what you see with the literature, when you tease out the two different, or you tease out the classes of food. So if you throw out all of the Western diet, all of the junk food, all of that kind of stuff, then what you see is that the foods that remain, the whole foods that have the saturated fats in them, those are actually beneficial, and they have beneficial effects on health, and they're very nutritious.
What do studies say about the ketogenic diet?
In relation to what? Do you want to talk about athletes or regular people or performance or what?
Yeah, I guess, you know, let's go to the athlete first. I think that would be because a lot of our nutrition comes from athletes into the regular world. And, you know, I think you use evidence from, it starts anecdotal in the bodybuilding world or in the high performance worlds, and then it gets dragged into regular civilian society. And sometimes that information gets all convoluted and misused. So let's start maybe at the source. Let's start with the athlete.
Sure. Okay. So with athletes, so if you're looking at ketogenic diet and athletic performance, what you see is that ketogenic diet loses. And they really tried their darndest to prove that a ketogenic diet could be beneficial for performance. So initially they're like, you know, ketogenic diet, the early days, they said ketogenic diet is just as good, if not better, than a high carbohydrate diet. We go high fat diet and that beats high carb diet. They tested it out with a lot of different sports, wasn't working. And they're like, okay, well, let's see what else we can do. Okay. So these are, you know, speaking from the perspective of the ketogenic diet people, they're like, okay, so fats are oxidizable fuel sources. Okay. So, you know, that means like they're slow and they might be better for endurance performance. So let's narrow it down. Let's go, let's say, you know, ketogenic diet is good for endurance performance. Let's test that out. So tested that out, didn't work. Wasn't showing any performance improvements. And more often than not, it was actually showing a performance decrement. And they're like, okay, well, let's go really, really, really low intensity, because, you know, even in endurance performances, like they're going as hard as they can because they're trying to win the race, right? Like right. They're trying to win the race. That's what we do in competitions. You try to push yourself as hard as you can, the maximal sustainable pace. And at the end, you got to be able to do that sprint still, right? Like you have to be able to do that sprint to the finish line. So they're like, okay, let's stack it in our favor as much as we can. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get race walkers. Okay. People who walk, that's going to be the lowest intensity sport that we can think of. We're going to get some race walkers and we're going to put them on a keto diet. And then what we're going to do is we're actually going to do a carb load protocol before the race, just to make sure that they have just as much carb stores as the high carb diet. And that way, you know, we've accounted for the carbs for the race and we've given them a keto diet beforehand. Let's see if this wins in the race walkers, and it still lost. So they've tried a lot of different ways to rig it in favor of the keto. And so for athletic performance, the main thing and the main reason why it doesn't work in athletic performance is because oxygen is the rate limiting step for athletic performance. And liter for liter consumed of oxygen, you get more energy out of the carbs than you do the fat. Okay. So what that means is I have to inhale a bunch more to get the same energy from fat as I do from a carb. And when you're exercising, when you're doing things, oxygen's limited, right? Like you're gasping for air. Yes. And in that instance, carbs win. They're a more efficient fuel source. They require less oxygen to get even more energy out of. So there's data and there's like a quote, I'm going to butcher it, but to paraphrase the quote, they say like the best endurance athlete will be the one who can consume the most carbs throughout the race. And basically what that means is because carbohydrates are the preferred fuel source, if you can completely shut off fat burning and you give yourself adequate carbs, then what you're going to be able to do is you're going to be able to compete at your peak. And so just to outline a little bit of the different roles, carbs are the only fuel source that can be burned and used for fuel without oxygen. So proteins and fats cannot be used without oxygen, but carbs can. So carbs have the added utility of when you're breathing oxygen, they can be used, and when you're not breathing with oxygen, they can be used. And they also are more efficient, so that you need less oxygen to be burned. The catch with carbs is that we have a very low storage capacity of them.
Right.
And so we tap out of our carb stores after just a couple hours of high intensity efforts. They classically call that bonking or hitting the wall in races. That's when your carb sources have gone to zero and your body is forced to switch to fats as a fuel. However, with races these days, usually there's little stands or you keep little gel packs with you or something, and you can like keep chugging, you know, the carbs right. to keep it going. So fats though, we have, you could survive like years on depending on how much fat you have. You could survive like a year on like just your fat stores alone. So it's a huge bank of energy. And there is some reason why you might want to be a better fat burner for the purpose of fuels. But when you go into a keto diet, what you're doing is you're collecting the number one resource that just based off of thermodynamics and physics, like it's a superior fuel source.
Yeah.
And so you need some hybrid of the two. For most sports, what you want is some hybrid of the two. And the bigger issue that I see with athletes going ketogenic diet though is that they do it incorrectly. They'll do it for like 6 days and then they'll go binge on Sunday or something, and they'll kind of flip-flop with this keto diet. And if you have a structured periodization program with it, that's fine. You can do that. But what you're actually doing, if you're just flip-flopping kind of willy-nilly, is you're training your body to be metabolically inflexible, which means you're becoming bad at burning carbs and you're bad at burning fats, which is like the worst case scenario. It's kind of like being a diabetic. And so what we'll do is, depending on your sport, you can actually test someone to see if they're burning at rest or during exercise. You can see if they're burning mainly carbs or mainly fats. And so you can use that information to say, okay, you have to exercise at 55% intensity for your sport and you are burning 100% carbs. And we want you to be able to burn 20% of that from fat. So we train you, and we train you by giving you like more fats and training low carb and all this kind of stuff. And we'll force your body to learn how to burn fats a little bit better. And on the flip side, if you're burning only fats, then you can train someone to be a better carb burner. And usually that helps out a lot of people who are feeling like they like power development. And you're just going from like a fuel source that is kind of slow and doesn't work all the time to something that gives you a lot more energy. And so usually what you see is you see some athletes who switch over and get better explosive performance is mainly what the carbohydrates do for you. And I feel like I rambled on a little bit, but one thing.
Oh, that's good. I think I find it really interesting that you can actually train for a specific reason to increase either your fat burning power or your carb burning power. I find that really an interesting concept, because you always talk about, you know, as an athlete, it's like, I want better endurance. I want more strength. I want more explosive power, but you never really factor in I never did anyway, so I can't speak for everybody, but where your fuel source was coming from and what you were trying to train that system. I think that's a super cool concept.
Yeah. And it's a lot of high level performance institutes are starting to do this kind of programming with their athletes now. It's usually more it has to be on an individual basis. You can't do it like team wide because everybody's different.
Right.
But yeah, it's a very high level strategy that you can employ to great success. And there are some instances where you want to push someone to be better fat burners. However, like I said, for most sports, ketogenic diet just doesn't work because you're going to be losing the most explosive fuel source that you have access to.
Yeah. You know, in my simple brain, I've always kind of likened it to having the keto diet or being fat fueled or whatever you wanted to call it, is like having a backup generator at the house. Like, we're as humans built to survive. It's like, hey, the food stores have gone down. There's no berries around. I'm not getting my root vegetables. You know, my carb stores are dwindling. However, I'm built to survive. So kick on the backup generator. The storm is coming. And now I can switch gears, burn fat for fuel. I've got a lot more of that on me as I go through the winter. And, you know, in my little head, that's kind of how I've classified the ketogenic diet, is because you don't feel optimal. You don't feel like you're burning fat. When I've done it before, it's like, you don't feel like you can get up and just go. It's like, there's this weird jelly almost that you have to work through before your body's like, it's a diesel system. It's like crank on the diesel in the winter. It's like, and your engine's just really struggling to fire. And then it's like, all right, here we go. We'll give you whatever you need. And, you know, it's like, but don't go too fast, because we don't do that, you know? So that's how I felt about that. I guess the one thing that I would say about, like, training in the off season and going kind of willy nilly, as you described it. It's like go keto for 6 days and then go hard on the carbs on Sunday or whatever. I guess what I would, the argument would be to perhaps training that is that maybe you are limiting your training capacity on the other thing. So you may be training your fuel source to the right percentages. However, you may be limiting your overall gains because you can't go hard enough in the training to get what you're looking for out of it ultimately.
Absolutely.
Off-season wise.
Yeah, absolutely. Usually in off-season is the time to, you know, alter your body composition, build up that, you know, cardiorespiratory base, you know, that strength base, all those kind of things. And if you go ketogenic, it's going to be a lot harder to engage in those high intensity efforts that will, you know, establish that. You can still function on a ketogenic diet, and you're absolutely right. That is actually the sole purpose. I mean, all the initial keto literature actually comes from starvation literature. Ketogenic diet is literally your backup fuel source. Your brain prefers carbohydrates to such a degree that you could be on keto for 5 years. And the second you, eat an apple, like all of a sudden it's like, give me that. That's mine. Like I need those.
Yeah.
You know? to your point though, with the off season, if you decide to go ketogenic diet, you can function. And the interesting thing is when you're on a ketogenic diet, your body still is forced to make carbs and still is forced to make glycogen. And so what it does is it will actually break down your other tissue to get it if you're not feeding yourself the carbs. So it's actually going to start eating your protein, AKA your muscles, in order to resynthesize your glycogen because it needs that for the activities you're doing. And so you'll notice is if you force yourself to do high intensity efforts and your body's forced to make this glycogen, it's got to get it from somewhere. So it starts eating itself in order to resynthesize that.
Wow.
And we can leave it there if we want, but so you got to be smart about it if you're doing it. And if you exercise, because your body was forced to resynthesize glycogen, usually the first day is fine. So when people go on keto and then they exercise the first day, it's usually fine and there's no problem.
Right.
It's if it takes as much as 24 to 48 hours to replenish that glycogen though. So if you try to exercise again, or like just the next morning or something like that, then you're going to feel like you're totally tapped out. But if you space it out, if you exercise just twice a week, like once every 3 days or so, you can still exercise and feel fine on the keto diet, but your body is breaking down other resources just because you're forcing it to, because you're not giving it the fuel it wants.
And lastly, I will ask you about keto for weight loss. There's a lot of people who think that you can't have carbs and lose weight at the same time, that keto is the only way. What does the literature say about that?
Okay. Keto for weight loss, it can be effective and it can be very simple to educate people. So as a practitioner, keto is a kind of like an elegant solution. It's like, I just tell you, eliminate all carbs and boom, right? I don't have to walk you through an entire plan. I don't have to give you all sorts of like nutrition information. I don't have to counsel you. Like I just say, eliminate all carbs. There you go. And what you see is that people who actually do that, they spontaneously reduce their caloric intake by, I believe it's 600 calories. So spontaneously, if you just tell someone to go keto, they're reducing their calories by 600 a day. They're losing about a pound a week and they're getting results off of that alone, which is nice. It's not because of the keto. It's just because they're in a calorie deficit. You can get weight loss. And in fact, most people do get weight loss while still eating carbs. The thing that sells a lot of people on keto though, is that you see an immediate drop of like 5 to 10 pounds in weight and during the first week. And that's entirely due to water weight because your carb stores, they're not solid. The carbs that are stored in your body, they're surrounded by water. And they bind the water, and it's like a 1-to-3 ratio. And so for every unit of carb that you lose, that you're burning as you're depleting your stores, you also have to flush out that water that was previously attached. And so you see this giant exodus of all this water in your body in the first week. And people are like, oh my God, I lost 5 pounds on keto immediately. Like, this is the best thing ever. And so that makes them feel good about it. And then on the back end, when the keto is unsustainable and they reintroduce the carbs, they eat like a piece of bread and suddenly they plump up by an extra like pound overnight. And it's like, oh my God, this validates the fact that carbs are evil because I gained so much weight the second I reintroduced carbs. And so you get these like confirmation biases that aren't actually linked to what's actually going on, that are misleading people into thinking ketogenic diets are, you know, the greatest ever. I have recommended ketogenic diets to people. There are some people who are very black and white, for example, and there are some people who are like, look, my problem foods are all carb foods. And if we just say, eliminate those, and they're like, that's all I needed to be told. Just make sure I stop eating these one things. And then it's like, okay, well, now we're getting results because we eliminated a problem food. I don't think that's good. I would very rarely recommend someone eliminate an entire food category. I think there's a lot of data that show that like, if you just, you know, eliminate an entire category of macronutrient, that you're actually going to be worse off in the long run, because, and there's data showing this, like you are more likely to have things like heart disease and metabolic disorders and things like that, because now you've eliminated an entire class of molecules and foods, stuffs that actually have a lot of beneficial nutrients in them. And now you're just never getting them. So as far as long-term health goes, it's not ideal. And it's going to be impairing your athletic performance. You will see a temporary drop in your weight just because it's water weight, but it's going to come right back the second that you get your, you eat some more carbs. But the weight loss that occurs between a high carb diet versus a high fat diet, for example, is going to be no different over time when you remove the water weight variable. It's purely comes back down to more of the energy balance equation.
Gotcha. Casey, awesome, buddy. Thank you.
Anytime. I love it.
Great work. I do too. I love listening. It's so easy. Well, it's easy for me to listen. It's the information's in your head. So thank you.